I've been thinking about money recently, largely due to the fact that I've sort of almost run out of it. Didn't have any, in the coffers were really quite empty. A couple of years ago we went to a conference and a guy prophesied that God would take us down to the wire, but we'd be alright. So I thought that was last year. It got worse this year. So anyway, we coped. So anyway, as it's turned out, I've got myself a job and I'm now replete again. Back on the way up, and the coffers are starting to fill. But it makes you think, doesn't it, when you don't have money, or when you do, it makes you think about it, and it makes challenges your thoughts and ideas about how much should you give away, that kind of thing. How much should you give to the work of the church? How much should you give to him who might ask you for some? That kind of thing. You know, does the Bible say that Christians should tithe? And questions like that. So I've been thinking about that a bit. And as I do, I like to think about things for quite a while. I've been thinking about it for a few weeks and I've been writing notes down. And it occurred to me during the week that it's going to take me about an hour and a half to say this. I can't possibly do it in the allotted time. So I've split it into two. So George has kindly volunteered me one of his slots in 4 weeks' time to do the second part. So I'm going to leave you hanging a bit today. So hopefully you'll be alright with that. The usual trawl of the internet, which I usually do, came up with a number of things. But what I noticed was that when you talk about offerings and tithes on the internet, there's lots of them come up that are all 10 reasons why you should give, or one was 100 verses about why you should give, 27 inspiring Bible verses about tithes and offerings, and it's all about inspiring you, it's all about urging you to give more. I suspect that they're written by people who maybe are recipients of these gifts in many cases, but nobody ever lays out a proper laid out structure for it. They want to inspire you and urge you. Well, personally, I don't like being inspired and urged. I like to know what it is that I'm being talked about, what's been talked about, and I will if it's from God, then the urge and inspiration will come from him. Thank you. So I intend to lay out, if I can, a picture for you, and I'm not going to be urging you, hopefully I will inspire you, but I'm not going to be urging you. I intend to teach rather than to exhort on this subject. The word tithe is an Old Testament word. It barely happens in the New Testament, hardly occurs. Anyway, because it's an Old Testament, I want to start with Old Testament teaching on it. I'm going to look at the main Old Testament teaching about tithing. I also want to look at some things that Jesus said about it. And next time, I want to go into more of what Jesus said. Not too fast. Not like that yet. Thank you. So I want to look at what Jesus said about tithing and what he said about money generally, because he said quite a few things, and a lot of his parables are about money in one way or another, or about giving. So we'll look at that next time. Now, I think it's worth noting that in Jesus' time, he lived at a changing a changing time. It was the end of the old covenant of the law and the start of a new covenant of grace, and there was a significant overlap in the days of Jesus, or specifically between the death and resurrection of Jesus. That's when the new covenant started. So some of the things he said are to do with the Old Covenant, and some of them are to do with the New Covenant. Anyway, so I will be leaving you dangling, and I hope you can cope with that. Right, there are three main Old Testament instances of offerings that predate the Jewish law, and Bernadette will put that up for us. They are, there's the three, I mean there may be others, but before the time of Moses, those are the three things that cropped up. Cain and Abel's offering to God. It's one of the earliest events in recorded human history. And we don't know quite why they desired to offer to God. But it didn't end well for them, did it? The one of them killed his brother because of the offering, or how it was received. So that's an example, Old Testament example, long time before the law of Moses. Genesis, the second one, Abraham's offering to Melchizedek. Remember that this is after the battle of the five kings, and Lot was kidnapped, and Abraham wanted to rescue Lot, and he got a coalition together of people who would help him, and they went and they retrieved Lot, and they retrieved a lot of spoils of war, which was the thing in them days, the spoils of war. So Abraham gave a tenth of the spoils of war to Melchizedek. No mention of Abraham's normal practice of giving. This was just the spoils of war. It wasn't his livestock and his grain and his olive oil and all that stuff that you might have thought was what constituted tithes. It was the spoils of war. And there's no indication given as to whether it was a normal practice for him, the giving, tithing to Melchizedek or anybody else. And then Jacob's example, Jacob basically said to God, if you will bless me, make me successful, then I will give you a tenth of everything. But we don't know whether he did any of that, and we don't know if it was a one-off gift that he was offering to give to God in the way that Abraham did in Melchizedek's example, or was it going to be a lifetime of giving God a tenth of everything? We don't know. It's not said, and we don't know. There's no example of whether he did it at all ever. So there's the three examples, and people use these examples to say, therefore you should tithe. But I don't see any evidence in those three examples myself, because they were one-off examples, and we don't know whether anybody ever did it anyway. Under Moses, it took a different direction. Under Moses, they were starting a new nation off, a nation that became the nation of Israel. And the law of Moses gave quite a lot of teaching about tithing and offerings also. But it's worth at this point saying that we're not under the law of Moses, we're under the law of grace. The law of Moses doesn't apply to us, but it's instructive to us. Now, John 1:17 says, the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth have come through Jesus Christ. So in the Old Testament, there were a number of offerings that referred to that related to special events in the life of the country, like when they were building the temple, when they were setting up the tabernacle, when they were rebuilding Jerusalem in the period that George referred to. There were special offerings taken, and people, sometimes there are lists of who gave what. Those are special offerings. But the main part of the teaching of Moses was to do with setting aside of the Levites, and you'll remember they were Moses and Aaron's tribe. They were Levites, and Aaron was the first high priest. And God said to, well, I'll go into it. We'll look at some of it. The Levites are one of the 12 tribes, and they were set apart by God for a special job. And important information is given about why God chose the Levites for this role, and you see it in Numbers 3:41. where God says, "And you shall take the Levites for me. I am the Lord." Well, I take that to be saying, "You shall take the Levites for me because I say so." You know, that's his reasoning. "I am the Lord. I'm saying it." That's what my dad used to say. "Because I say so." What's the reason? "Because I say so." Well, why? "Because I say so." And that's the reason God gave for selecting the Levites. "Because I say so. I am the Lord." So the setting apart of the Levites and their later support system was so that God would get his due. We have to look into that a bit, because it's about God getting his due. What is owed to God? God had, just before the time of the law being written down and Moses going up the mountain to get the Ten Commandments, etc. Just prior to that, they'd been rescued out of Egypt. And God had saved the Israelites out of Egypt. And right at the end of that, in the 10th plague, the Egyptians had lost their firstborn sons. That was the 10th plague. But it did not come to the Israelites. They were saved from the 10th plague. None of their firstborn sons were killed, and none of their firstborn animals were killed. And in a sense, they owed God their firstborn sons. Why? Because he said so. God said that they owed him. You think, oh, it's weird. But he did. He said, "Because I say so. Set apart for me the Levites." The whole number of the firstborn sons of Israel who were owed to God was 22,273. And God says, "Set apart for me the Levites." How many of them were there? There were 22,000 exactly. 273 different. The shortfall of the 273 still owed to God, God said, "Well, you can redeem those two, and I don't need to select 273 people who aren't Levites to join them. You can redeem them for 5 shekels of silver each." And that's the first story, really, of redemption in the Bible. There may be allusions to it and types of redemption earlier, but that's the first example of somebody being bought back. So the 273, they were bought back. They were bought back from God. And you think, that's the other way around, surely. Don't we think of people being redeemed to God? No, they were bought back from God. They were God's to do with what he wished, and he could have said sacrifice them. But no, he said you can buy them back and they can get on living a normal life for 5 shekels each. 5 shekels is about, well, shekels about 11 grams of, and it was 5 shekels of silver, so that's 55 grams of silver. If you're up to date with these things, you'll know that this is about 19 quid. So not a vast fortune. Silver last week was 35p a gram. So this 273 people were redeemed, bought back from God for £273.19. About £5.50. God claimed the firstborn males at that time and in each successive generation. So that was what happened with the first generation, just explained it. But successively, when the family had a firstborn son, that firstborn child, technically speaking, belonged to God. And in some cases, obviously, you know, one example is, Samuel. Thank you. Samuel. Samuel was given to God, wasn't he? But technically speaking, God owned all the firstborn children, and they all had to be redeemed and paid for what price? 5 shekels of silver. So people would go to the temple or it would have been the temple if they were able, when their babies, or just after their babies were born, and redeem them for 5 shekels. And that went on, well, it should have gone on the whole time, but I dare say they didn't do it properly, as they failed to do quite a few things. But they didn't just do the firstborn children, the firstborn sons. They also did the firstborn animals. So if you had cows and horses and sheep and goats and whatever animals you had, they had to be redeemed. They had to be bought back. Except for goats, sheep and cows. They couldn't be redeemed. They had to be sacrificed. So that's what happened. Presumably if a sheep had the firstborn lamb, a male one, that one was sacrificed. All the following on ones, the other 20 or 30 that the sheep would give birth to over the years, they didn't belong to God. They were for them to do what they wanted with. But that principle of God owning the firstborns features through the whole picture. Redemption, buying back from God, is a subject quite dear to our hearts, isn't it? We've been thinking about it this morning already. Just as the Israelites were doomed to continued slavery or death at the hands of the Egyptians, and God rescued them to be a people for himself, just like that happened, God has rescued us from slavery to be a people for himself. Our slavery would be slavery to sin and to inevitable empty lives outside of Christ and worthless existences. As Peter says, we've been saved from the empty ways inherited by our fathers, from our fathers. It's not to say that everybody is an empty and useless person who isn't a Christian, but it's empty ways, purposeless life in God's mind. God has saved us from that to be his own possession. Because of our sin, we deserve death at his hands. But because he loves us, he has redeemed us from death by the levy of a redemption price. Would it be 5 shekels of silver again? Maybe. But this redemption price was not paid by us. We haven't paid our redemption price. It wasn't paid by a member of our family. It wasn't paid by a member of our tribe or anybody in our country. There was only one out of the entire human race that was worthy enough in God's eyes to pay that redemption price. And it turns out it was God himself who did it. He became one of us so that the price would be like for like. That we would be bought back from the hands of an angry God to serve him. How much was that redemption worth? However many, say a billion people, 5 shekels each, doesn't sound very much. Well, I don't know. 19 billion quid is quite a lot, but it says we've not been redeemed by silver or gold. We've been redeemed by the precious blood of Christ. And it's compared with silver and it's compared with gold. And it said it's not like silver, or even like gold, which is obviously quite a lot more expensive than silver. But it's by the precious blood of Christ, which is of infinite value, inestimable. You couldn't put a value on it. Certainly not 35p a gram. It's way more than that. So we owe God a debt for the redemption, but it's a debt of gratitude now. So God isn't asking us give him 5 shekels of silver. He's asking us to have gratitude, to be thankful for what he's done for us. So anyway, remembering redemption and the important subject that is for us as Christians, we'll press on. The first tithe. Now, when I looked at this, I thought, what's he on about, first tithe? There's the first, there's the second, and there's the third tithe. I didn't know that. I do now. Numbers 18 talks about the setting up of the main tithe. There we are, three tithes. Numbers 18, the main tithe was the payment by the people to God for the ongoing support of the Levites, which we just read about a few minutes ago. They needed regular, long-term support so that they could continue to be doing duties for God. So it is about what God is owed. God is owed support, you know, God is owed the worship. The Levites are set aside by the people to do the worship, to enable the people to worship God in the correct way. They handled all the stuff to do with worship, and they needed regular support. So the first tithe was everybody gave 10% of their cattle, their grain, their sheep, etc. And it was given to the Levites. And in turn, the Levites would give 10% of what they received to support the priests amongst them. Because not all Levites were priests. Some Levites were priests, and they're referred to as Kohanim or Kohens. So if you know somebody who's called Kohen, it's probably a priest or from a priestly family. So that's the first tithe. And it was set at 10% of everything. So that's 10% of everything within a year. You know, so everything that had grown during that year, any animals that were born during that year, not obviously the firstborns, because they were dealt with separately, as I've already said, but everything else was taxed. I think it's interesting that the word levy is used. It was levied. You know, we levy taxation, don't we? Well, we don't, but the government do. And levy sounds a lot like Levi and Levites. And interesting, Jesus' disciple Matthew used to be called Levi. And what was his job? Tax collector. Yeah. So Levi, tax collector, levies, they all come from the same root. So that's the first tithe. Supporting the priests, supporting the Levites. The work of the ministry, you might say. The second tithe is covered in Deuteronomy 14. And that's quite an interesting one, because I'd never even knew there was one. But they were told to, similarly, set aside monies for what purpose? There we are. Bring it to Jerusalem at the times of the festivals. It was for their own support at the festivals. And I remember God had said to them that they had to go to Jerusalem three times a year, which if you lived 100 miles away wasn't an easy thing to do. And because it wasn't easy to take a load of cattle and sheep and grain with you, they were allowed to sell it locally where they lived and take the money with them. And then when they got to Jerusalem, they could use the money to buy some animals back for their sacrifices. And the rest of the money was for them to pay for their travelling, for their accommodation, and for their food and drink. And it says that they could eat and drink whatever they wanted. Whatever they wanted, whatever your heart desires, you can eat and drink. Even wine and strong drink. You think, oh, I never thought that was in the Bible. Who'd have thought that? Wine and strong drink. Why? Because God wants joyful people at his festivals. So they go to the festivals, they've put aside a lot of money during the year for that, and it's so that they could be at the festivals that God wanted them to be at, and that they'd be happy about it. Well, they would, wouldn't they? They'd be delighted if you got to spend 10% of your income in a week, or 3% twice, three times a year, having a good time at the festival. This business of buying back the animals when you got there for the sacrifices, Jesus criticised, didn't he, the temple system that where animals were sold back to people at exorbitant prices. It should have been, when they sold the stuff locally to where they lived and brought the money with them, they should have been able to buy a sheep or a goat at the proper price. But no, it was an elevated price, wasn't it? The temple. Jesus was so annoyed about that, he turned over their tables for that kind of corruption in the system. But that's where that comes from. Then there was the third tithe, which is also in Deuteronomy. Next chapter, I think. Might be Deuteronomy 15, I'm not sure. No, I've got it in 14 here. Deuteronomy 15, 4 to 11. I know, in Deuteronomy 15 it says there shouldn't really be any poor people in Israel because they were supposed to be covered by the society was run. There shouldn't really be any, but Deuteronomy 14 talks about the third tithe. And it says in the third and sixth years of a 7-year cycle they were to lay aside monies and grain and animals and whatnot, and just let anybody who was poor come and take what they needed. So it was specifically for the benefit of the poor. So 2/7 of 10%, you might say. Not quite sure. There's some doubt as to whether the second tithe and the third tithe are really talking about the same thing, and one's 5/7 and one's 2/7. It's not clear in the Bible whether that's the same thing. But it could be that it's whatever 2/7 is, 28%. It could be 2.8% of their income laid aside in tithes. Not sure about the exact numbers there. But the Levites were, and the others, other poor people, for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, and the Levites. They could come and eat their fill with what you'd laid aside. These things are still with us, aren't they? These needs. There's still needs for people who are sojourners, who maybe are living in a country that isn't their own. We have a different word for them these days. What do we call them these days? Refugees. People who have come to our country for refuge. Refugees, fatherless, people who didn't have income because their father had died. Widows didn't have income because their husband had died. Maybe they were supported by their family, but some weren't. So that third tithe was to help them out. So that's the law of Moses. And you'd think if everybody was doing that, then all the needs would be met, wouldn't they? There'd be loads of money sloshing around for the benefit of the poor and needy, and for the Levites, and the festivals would be brilliant. And there are loads of other examples about generosity in the Proverbs and Psalms and the Prophets. Whoever oppresses the poor shows contempt for their maker, but whoever is kind to the needy honours God. Well, I think that's timeless. Don't see that that's anything to do with the law of Moses. Whoever is kind to the poor lends to the Lord, and he will reward them for what they've done. So care for the poor is dear to God's heart. We were mentioning food bank earlier. It's dear to God's heart, things like that. We have an ongoing obligation to help those in dire need. In Israel, this was not a state obligation. It was devolved to every individual. It's interesting, I think. In our society, mostly, it's a state obligation. You know, the state hands out various offerings to help people who are poor, but it was devolved to every Israelite in Israel. So that's the tithes. Tithes were given to support the Levitical system, to attend the regular festivals in Jerusalem, and to help the poorest people in society. I look to see, I'll get into this another time. I want to get on to what Jesus said about tithes a bit. The Old Testament principles of tithing still applied in Jesus' day, as you know. I mean, he was a Jew. It says that Jesus was Well, Galatians 4:4 says, when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. So Jesus was born under the law. He was obliged to pay tithes and all the other things that went with the Jewish law. And his disciples were as well. In fact, all of the people we read about in the New Testament, mostly, a few of them were Gentiles, but in the main, they were mostly Hebrews. In Jesus' day, there wasn't just the Israeli state. They were under occupation, and there were the Romans in camp, and they were levying their own taxation system, like governments do, especially ones with strong armies. So there was, and Jesus didn't object to that. He said, well, render to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. No problem with that. Pay both. Jesus went on to fully keep and indeed fulfill the law. He said, don't think I've come to abolish the law. No jot or tittle out of this law will cease to be relevant until everything's accomplished. I'm not quite sure about what he means by everything being accomplished, but it could be referring to the end of the Mosaic Covenant, which was sort of finished in AD 70 when the Romans destroyed the temple and sacked Jerusalem. But between Jesus' resurrection and AD 70, both systems were in operation. So in Jesus' day, temple worship was still going on. The temple worship system still required support. And presumably, by that time, the devolved synagogue system also needed support, because there were synagogues. When did synagogues start? 200 or 300 years before Christ. Maybe as early as 500 and something years before Christ. But they were local expressions of worship, as opposed to the temple in Jerusalem. And there were still poor people around. And we know that Jesus and his disciples held a bag for the benefit of the poor. Don't we? We know that. We're told that Judas held the bag. He was the keeper of the money, the purpose of which was to help poor people that they came across. So they were doing that. It wasn't the third tithe as such, but it was still giving to the poor. Jesus commended the poor woman, didn't he? When he was sitting by the temple and he saw a woman put a coin into the box, a collection box. Probably she was given the temple tax. It doesn't say why she was putting the money in the box, but there was a thing called the temple tax. That was set at half a shekel, so about £2. As Jesus looked up, he saw the rich. This is in Luke 21. He saw the rich putting their gifts into the temple treasury. He also saw a poor widow put in 2 very small copper coins. Truly I tell you, he said, this poor widow has put in more than all the others. All these people gave their gifts out of their wealth, but she out of her poverty put in all she had to live on. Well, if it was the temple tax, that was a tax that she shouldn't have been paying anyway. The temple tax was levied on all males over the age of 20 in Israel. Certainly not poor people who are widows. No women, no widows. No wonder he was angry about those corrupt practices. Incidentally, the temple tax was paid by Jews from all over the known world. It was a bit of a irritation to the Romans. So after the temple was destroyed by the Romans, they instituted a temple tax of their own. And all the money was given to in Rome to the temple of Jupiter Optimus Maximus. So that was a bit of an irritation to the Jews, having to give money to the Jews who lived in Rome to the Roman temple instead of their own. Jesus pronounced woes against the Pharisees of his day because they tithed all sorts of things. They tithed all the mint and herbs and all the various herbs. And he said they were right to do that. But they should have also looked after the other weightier matters of the law, like looking after the fatherless, the widows and the orphans and people in need. So which Jesus referred to as the weightier matters. But he didn't say that you shouldn't be tithing. It was clear then that the process of tithing was still practiced amongst Jews in his day. I'm going to get on to many more things that Jesus said about money and about giving and being generous next time. I would have liked to have done some more this time, but you've only got so many minutes. And since I've called this talk Tithes and Offerings, I've mostly talked about tithes, I want to give you 7 reasons, in my opinion, why we don't have to tithe. Now, don't go and stop your bank standing orders as soon as you get home, if you've got online banking, because next time I'm going to give you lots of reasons why giving to God is a good thing. But 7 reasons why we shouldn't tithe. Tithe there having the Jewish connotation that we've gone through already. Well, the first reason is, well, there you are, we're not under the Mosaic covenant. We're under the new law, a covenant of grace. We're not Jews. Maybe I'll get on to that. The first point, we're not under the Mosaic covenant. Well, largely because A, we're not Jews, and B, because the Mosaic covenant ended probably in AD 70. Second point is that I already raised the examples of Abraham and Jacob that we read pre-law. They're not normative patterns. There's no indication that they were lifelong patterns of giving. They were one-off events. There's no evidence that they regularly gave God a tenth of everything. Tithes, point 3, were given to the Levites and priests for their support, and rightly so. There were a load of, 22,000 and increasing over the years, 22,273 plus growth, Levites and priests. But there aren't any Levites and priests in the New Covenant. We're all priests. None of us are Levites in the New Covenant. Fourth point, the tithe was tied to the land, remembering that the Israelite society was agrarian. They were all farmers, mostly. Nearly all of them were farmers, although gradually as cities were built and some of them took up what you might call city-type jobs. Carpentry, for example. There would have been carpenters out in farms as well, but the tithe was tied to the land. It's to do with the land that you'd been given by Moses to your tribe and that had been apportioned out to your clan and to your family. And it was all linked around worship where it says, the place I will show you, it says in Deuteronomy. Well, that became Jerusalem, didn't it, later on? It was all about, it hinged around the temple in Jerusalem. Well, that went. There's no temple. If there was a temple, which would cause quite an upheaval in the world, I think, if there was a temple, it might happen. There might become a temple in the future. Will we be giving money to the temple in Jerusalem? I don't think we will, personally. The Jews may well. The tithe is tied to the land of Israel, and specifically to the temple. Point 5, if tithing was required today, well, shouldn't it be 22 2/7%? I don't know. Why do we set it at 10? I don't know. Just is. Why is it? Don't know. Because the first tithe was 10. Yeah, but what about tithe 2 and tithe 3? Wouldn't it be better to set it at 20 if you're going to? Not many churches follow this pattern, I can tell you. There is one that does, at least. Was a Christian cult, but now it's been brought into the worldwide church. Used to be called the Armstrongites. Nothing to do with Joe and Sandra. But they still teach on the first tithe, the second tithe, and the third tithe within their church. But I don't know anybody else who does. So that's point number five. Point number six, when Jesus affirmed tithing, it was to Jews and before the dawn of the new covenant. Well, it was. Some people think that the argument that Jesus said about the Pharisees tithing dill and mint and cumin and all those other herbs is a pervasive argument and should be imply that we all should tithe. But lots of other things that Jesus said aren't treated in that way. So I think it's a weak argument. And point seven. Nowhere in the New Testament where giving is mentioned, and quite a few places where commands to give generously are found in the New Testament, nowhere is tithing endorsed. Well, you'd have thought that the opportunity was there for St. Paul to mention tithing when he wrote about giving in 1 Corinthians and other places. Well, he didn't, and none of them did. So, and there's lots of examples in Acts 2, 43 to 47, Acts 4, Acts 11, Galatians 2, 1 Corinthians 16, 2 Corinthians 8, 2 Corinthians 9. Lots of places where giving and giving generously is mentioned. Tithing isn't mentioned. Doesn't mean to say that the thought behind the tithing, you know, the support of Levites, the support of festivals and the support of poor people, because it says that the law of God is now written on our hearts. It's not written in tablets of stone for us, it's written in our hearts. So that means that the things that were important principles within the law, they're now written in my heart, so I should want to give. I'm not going to tithe, I'm not going to give money to the temple in Jerusalem, etc. But it should be written in our hearts that we'd want to be generous and giving. And Jesus spoke about that. He pointed to the heart and not to the tithes. Yeah, Martin Luther said, when people are converted, he says there's typically three conversions that they go through. One is the conversion of their heart, one is the conversion of their mind, and the third is the conversion of their money, or their attitude to it. And I think he's not far off the truth, that there are those things. Lots of Christians over the years have regarded three important duties that the Christians have. One is to give alms, one is to fast, and one is to pray. You think, yeah, okay, I can go along with that. Those things are important. But it includes the giving of alms. ALMS, not ARMS. So there we are. Tithes and offerings in the Old Testament. Principles that are set up for that. Maybe the principles continue, but the specific way it was done has long since gone. And it was going throughout the Old Testament. And if you look at what goes on in Jewish circles these days, they don't tithe. Now, what's it cost you to be a Jew nowadays? Well, it depends what synagogue you go to. Some of them charge you they levy a fixed amount for being a member of that synagogue, somewhere between 1% and 2.5%. Bear in mind, these people are also paying taxes to the governments of the countries they live in. But there's a lot of debate in those circles as to what should be given for the support of the work. So, I'm more or less finished. I've left us in a precarious position, and you could all go home and cancel your offerings. I'm hoping that you won't do, because I'm continuing in 4 weeks' time to look at much more what Jesus said about money and giving, and what St. Paul had to say about it in some of the passages I've mentioned. There we are. George, shall I just pray, or do you want to? Father, we thank you. Thank you for the what we've read today about redemption, that we've been bought with a price. We didn't pay our own price. Jesus paid it for us. Thank you for that redemptive price. Thank you that it was the blood of Jesus Christ that washes away all sin, makes us all acceptable to you. We've been brought back from the prospect of hell and given life now in your family. Help us to live as members of your family in an appropriate way. I pray that we, at our hearts will be changed so that we are converted in heart, mind and money. That we'll be living lives that where we're not governed by money. We're not ruled by money, we're ruled by you. Nobody can love God and mammon. Lord, we ask that you'd set us free from the entractions of money, which you spoke about many times and we'll look at next time. And help us to be generous with our hearts. Amen. George.
Thank you, Ray. And that concludes our service today. So, plenty to think about. Look forward to 4 weeks' time. So please stay behind. There will be tea and coffee served in the youth hall. Discuss what's been said this morning and don't rush out the door. We'd love to chat with you. And if anybody requires prayer, please feel free to come forward. We will gladly pray with you. Be blessed.